This is the Infotagem podcast, focused on the work of the Joint Committee of the Draft Online Safety Bill. In this show, we'll be focused on the evidence sessions where the committee examined whether scam ads and fraudulent ads should be within scope of the bill. We also heard from the Facebook whistleblower Sophie Zhang in her first ever live testimony in front of a parliamentary committee, and the evidence sessions where we discussed the barriers of freedom of expression and the harm that expression can cause other people and how you get those tensions right. But first up, we'll be hearing from Martin Lewis, who has been an impassioned campaigner to include fraudulent ads within the scope of the legislation based on his own experience of his image and his name as a money-saving expert being used to promote products online of which he had no responsibility and which led to other people losing money.
We put the government on notice 4 years ago that this country faces an epidemic of scams that is damaging people's wealth and their mental health. Money and Mental Health Policy Institute, which I chair, you know, one in three people suffer depression after scams, never mind the hideous impact on those with mental health. And the idea of waiting another 2 years when that epidemic was, you know, exploded through the pandemic when things got even worse is hideous. Lives are being absolutely destroyed. And I just want to put something, and Rossi has said it, but I want to make it more plain. The way this bill is currently structured incentivizes scammers to create more scam ads because that type of scam is not covered by it and user-generated is. And it is a farcical distinction that harks back to the 1980s when you had content and advertising on television and in newspapers that were distinctly separate. You tell me, if I do a post and then pay to promote it, is it an ad or is it user-generated? If I do a dating profile and then pay to promote it, is it an ad, is it user-generated? Where do I cross the line? And if the answer is as soon as I pay, it's an advert, then all I have to do is pay a penny and every one of my user-generated posts is not covered by this bill. It is ridiculous. It is farcical. And to add to what Rossi has said, she missed out the ABI. She missed out most big banks. I'm on her side. We're together on this. I'm not right? But she missed them out. And when you consider that the consumer groups, the charities, the banks, the insurers are all saying, put this in the bloody bill, you have to get close to thinking, it almost seems like a conspiracy that it is not being put in the bill. Now, I don't believe in conspiracies, but if anything were to persuade me, the blank reaction I get from the government who say we need to look at it more carefully. I sued Facebook 3 years ago. This has been going on for years. We've had meeting after meeting after meeting. No, enough is enough.
We now hear from the City of London Police Commander, Clinton Blackburn, and Dr. Michael Grenfell, who's the Executive Director of the Competition and Markets Authority, who add their weight to Martin's call for fraudulent ads to be included in the scope of the bill.
A lot of this enforcement work falls into the hands of the City of London Police. I mean, what's your assessment of not just the scale of the problem, but also the growth of the need to investigate these crimes?
Thank you. So, I'm a real strong advocate of including the paid-for advertising and actually also taking it further in terms of actually naming fraud as a priority. I mean, certainly what we've seen since April 2019, and obviously with, you know, COVID happening, more people be going online, we've seen a real drive into the online space. What we can say is we've seen a 16% increase in cases where the fraud is absolutely attributed to online advertising, to communications platform. And just to give you some sort of figures, in online shopping and auction, for example, has increased in that time by 43%. Romance fraud, 15%, and again, increases year on year with the majority being online. Investment fraud, we've seen a 16% increase as well. So we are seeing a real drive to this kind of area of criminality as banks have tightened up methods around payments. That whole advertising piece online, social media sites, is really where people are propagating fraud. And we've seen certainly between this year and the last reporting year a 4% increase just in that short period alone as well.
May I briefly make a point which follows from what we've heard? I mean, if one can go after the actual wrongdoers, that's great, but there are problems. I mean, one is the problem that some of them are outside the jurisdiction, but the other is what Mark called the whack-a-mole problem. I mean, we did that with fake online reviews. We went after individual perpetrators, but then others pop up. The real thing has to be that the platforms themselves take responsibility.
In her evidence, Sophie Zhang told us there needs to be a complete culture change at Facebook, a change so that the public policy and government affairs teams that deal with politicians should be separate from people that look out for the safety of ordinary citizens on the platform.
In terms of, for instance, changing the culture at Facebook, or at least creating measures by the company with regards to Ofcom to regulate the company, that it's, I have several suggestions that I could make there. The first is in terms of requiring the companies to protect its policy, to apply policies consistently, which is, I believe, in clauses 9 through 14 of the bill. Because the idea that fake accounts should be taken down, this was written into Facebook's policies, and what I saw was that there was a perverse effect in that if I found fake accounts that were not directly tied to any political leader or figure, they were often easier to take down than if I found fake accounts that were. And so this created a perverse effect in that it creates an incentive for major political figures to essentially create a crime openly. Imagine a situation in which, suppose, a burglar robs a bank and then the police would hopefully arrest them very quickly. But suppose a burglar robs a bank and the burglar is a member of parliament who is not wearing a mask and openly shows his face, and the police decides to take a year to arrest him because they are not sure about arresting a member of parliament. That is essentially the analogy going on at Facebook. And so others have made a proposal to require companies over a certain size to separate product policy and outreach and governmental affairs. Because at Facebook, the people charged with making important decisions about what the rules are and how the rules get enforced are the same people as those charged with keeping good relationships with local politicians and governmental members, which creates a natural conflict of interest. Because Facebook is a private company, but so is, for instance, The Telegraph, The Guardian, etc. And those organizations keep, at least I hope, keep the editorial department very separate from their business department.
In the evidence session focused on harmful but legal content, Professor Richard Wilson from the University of Connecticut told the committee that it should look first at dealing with illegal content rather than tackling legal but harmful content. And here's what he had to say about that.
Perhaps my recommendation would be to go after the low-hanging fruit, first of all. There is plenty of incitement, harassment, coordinated campaigns of online abuse already that are not being currently regulated. And so rather than going for the more difficult, the gray area of disparaging, potentially racist or misogynist comments, there's plenty of material already on social media platforms and through the search engines, and you can access other content that already does break existing laws on incitement to terrorism and so on. So I suppose my recommendation would be to go the more cautious route and suppress that which is already illegal.
We now hear from Big Brother Watch's Silky Carlo on the issue of whether we should regulate content or regulate the algorithms that promote content.
There are different ways that a policy in this area could play out, and I think what we would be uncomfortable with is giving the state defining certain categories of lawful speech that foreign companies would then have to suppress, because that's what we're talking about. They already amplify content because they essentially editorialize with news feeds, recommendations, advertisements, and so on. So we'd be talking about setting out a specific number of categories and saying, don't advertise this. This is semi-banned content. And I think that could be, I think that is a very slippery slope. I think at a systems level, the kind of transparency that Matthew spoke about is vital. And I think there's unanimous agreement on that. There is no reason that we shouldn't be able to see what, how these, given the importance to democracy and social cohesion and everything else, we ought to see what, how the algorithms work and what types of content are being pushed through this editorialization process. On the individual level, though, I would urge caution about designating lawful content that is essentially semi-banned. But the most important thing that policymakers could do to prevent over-amplification of harmful content to individuals and radicalization spirals, etc., is to ban micro-targeted advertising by the social media companies. It would be a revolutionary change. It would mean that these extremely harmful journeys that individuals go on would be prevented. It would also prevent a lot of the harms to democracy that we've seen perpetrated by some of these companies. Micro-targeted advertising currently exists within a total regulatory and legal gap. And I was quite surprised after the Cambridge Analytica scandal and other things that we've seen in recent years that that is completely unaddressed.
Finally, Peter Wright from the Daily Mail Group explains to the committee why he supports the exemption in the bill for journalistic and media content to be included in the regulation of online harm.
My reading of the bill is that we're protected in the first case by the fact that the duty of care does not apply to our content, both on our own websites, but also when it's distributed on search and social media. So there's no obligation on the platforms to censor our content. However, the problem comes because there is also no compulsion on them not to. And clearly the authors of the bill envisage that they will block and take down items of content because the journalistic protections are there, and the journalistic protections specifically apply to news publisher content. So we have to look at the journalistic protections and ask how effective they are. And in my view, they're not effective. The problem with any sort of moderation of content by social media companies is that they'll do it by algorithm. The bill puts them under threat of very, very heavy penalties, possibly even criminal penalties, we heard yesterday. And their inevitable response to that will be to set the parameters of any moderation they do as widely as possible. It's human nature. They'll want to protect themselves. So they'll be using a very blunt instrument. I saw in Google's submission, they say their algorithms are very poor at understanding context. They're going to find moderating journalism particularly difficult. And we also know from articles in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend that Facebook's artificial intelligence is very poor at actually moderating this type of content.
To discuss these evidence sessions, I'm now joined by my committee colleague, Lord Jim Knight from the House of Lords. Jim, it's great to have you with us on the podcast. And I wanted to start off by just talking about the evidence session we had with Martin Lewis and others talking about scam ads and fraudulent ads and whether they should be included within the scope of the Online Safety Bill. I think this is one of the really big, really important issues that we've had to consider as a committee.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a pleasure to join you on the podcast, Damien. For me, this is an area where, you know, a bill that I broadly support, I think, as the whole committee does in terms of what the bill's trying to do, but where I think the government has not yet got it right. And the passion that Martin Lewis had in particular around his experience in the end having to sue Facebook for defamation in order to try and prevent his face being used in scam ads was a demonstration, I guess, as to how urgent it is that we need to get on with this. Because, you know, as I'm sure you do, Damien, I understand that the government is separately thinking about how to regulate online advertising. But, you know, in my view, we can get on and get advertising in scope, and there are some other reasons that we can explore attached to that. And then if subsequent legislation, as a result of further work that the government does, wants to replace that or to augment that in some way as a result of further thinking that they've done, that's fine. But let's get something done now, as Martin said very strongly to us, rather than, you know, kick the can down the road yet again.
I think that's right. And I think it would just seem very odd that you can have sort of one set of content which is considered to be illegal or harmful and needs to be removed if it's posted organically on someone's Facebook page. But as soon as you put a sort of penny of spend behind it, it becomes an ad, then it's exempt from the regulations. I think from a user's point of view, they would just say, well, if you're doing something illegal, like trying to defraud people of money, that should be illegal, whether it's an ad or whether it's just something you've posted.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot in the last few weeks is the way in which the social media platforms have sought to integrate advertising into the whole user experience, into the newsfeed or into what you do when you're watching YouTube or whatever. And that's in order, as far as the platform's concerned, to improve the user experience. And they are algorithmically trying to ensure that the ads are as relevant as possible to what they know about those users, which is kind of everything. But what that then means, when it's an integrated experience of organic and paid for content, is you kind of got to be able to look at that whole user experience and regulate any potential harm across the piece, not just pick out organic separately from paid for. And in the end, I don't think there's any choice if we're going to ask the regulator to do a thorough job on harm. And what you're saying about paying that extra pound to then suddenly circumnavigate things, it's also the case when we look at Google. You know, the agencies that they own place a huge amount of the advertising is there, and including the advertising online that's responsible for misinformation. And they need to be regulated around all of that too, as part of this overall aim that we all share with the bill in order to make the online world a much safer place.
Absolutely. Now, we heard as well from Sophie Zhang, another whistleblower from Facebook. Her experience was looking at networks of fake accounts operating in different countries around the world, and in particular where they may be engaged in activity to try and undermine an election. And I was really struck by the story she told us about the work she did looking at Honduras, where she had reported suspicious activity that was serious. And it took months, over a year, I think, for Facebook to do anything about it. And I think this says a lot about the extent to which companies like Facebook take these issues seriously, particularly if they affect countries outside of Western Europe and the US, and the extent to which they've got anything like the resources they need to effectively moderate content in those countries.
Yeah, it was shocking, the Honduras case and some of the other countries that she'd done work with this sort of systematic use of fake accounts to at scale in order to be able to make a politician, in that case, look popular. The use of private groups and being able to enroll people again at scale into private groups so that the private group content then appears on their newsfeed. All of that is a pattern of behavior around the use of Facebook. And then from Facebook's point of view, I guess there is a pattern of behavior, which is look, it's a public listed company. It has to do quarterly reporting. It is concerned, you know, it has a 43% profit margin on its business. And it is concerned where their commercial interests are in play. So it's concerned about the US. It acted, you know, too little too late, I think, around the US election. But there's not much commercial interest in Honduras. There's not much commercial interest in some of the other places where the impact on democracy feels to be pretty profound. And they don't appear to be prioritizing the resource in order to be able to deal with that, because in the end, it's not going to affect their share price.
No, that's right. But it does affect those countries, often very dramatically, because, yeah, you know, those in those countries, it may be more, it's more likely Facebook plays a dominant role in media. In some countries around the world, it almost is the internet, where people access the internet almost exclusively through Facebook, and therefore the damage that could be done in countries like that with disinformation networks in a country like Honduras, or in a more extreme way through actual violence being organized and planned on Facebook in Myanmar.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, there may be some people who would be going, yeah, but you know, this bill is about regulating the UK and making the online experience in the UK a safer place. Why should we be talking about or worried about Honduras and Myanmar? And I think I would say to that is, there are also some examples of things that have taken place here in this country where some of these sorts of techniques, not at the same sort of scale and not attached to national elections that I'm aware of, but what is being practiced almost industrially in some of those other countries are practices that we need to be concerned about in polluting our own democracy here. And so I think it's entirely in scope for us to be concerned about it and for what our regulators to be able to want to do something about it. Partly also because I think, and we've heard from countless witnesses, haven't we, that the world is looking to the UK in taking a lead on all of this. And if we can get this right, then we can also help some of those other countries and some of those other struggling democracies around the world.
Absolutely. I mean, there's, I mean, another important topic we've discussed in this podcast and from the clips that we played earlier on is the whole question around, I think, you know, legal but harmful content on social media and how that sits within the context of the regulatory framework in the bill and the age-old argument that runs alongside that, the tension between people's freedom of speech rights and the harm that speech can cause other people. And the right of journalists and media organizations to be able to speak freely in an open democracy as well. I mean, as we've gone through the evidence we've taken, where do you think this balance lies at the moment?
I think it's one of the hardest conundrums attached to all of this. And yeah, there's certainly quite a lot of noise, especially yeah, online, from people who are really purist about this and think that the this bill committee and the bill and the government are trying to do something profoundly anti-British, and that this, you know, Britishness is all about freedom of speech, and why can't we have a freedom of speech enshrined in some kind of constitution where they do in the United States, etc. In the end, I sort of in a way take it back to the real world space and go, look, you know, if I'm saying outrageous, untruthful things in a pub, then the publican can chuck me out. But generally, you know, if I'm being offensive, and you know, the platforms could do the equivalent online. But you know, I'm not impacting a whole bunch of people because there aren't that many people in the pub. The problem with the online space and the freedom to say whatever you like to whoever you like, often with anonymity, is you're doing so at scale, and you have the systems and processes of the platform. If they think that your content is engaging, possibly because it's emotive in a negative way, then their systems amplify it so that it's much, much bigger a deal than what's happening in the pub. And that goes to what Sophie was saying to us in her evidence, which is, yeah, freedom of speech is really important, and we should retain that. But that doesn't mean that you have freedom of distribution. You have the right to have your bileful content to be amplified by the algorithms and the systems that are in place in the platforms. And I agree with that. I think we need to constrain the harm from legal freedom of speech by being mindful of the reach that some of that speech can have and the harm it can therefore create. So we're not stopping people saying things so much, but we are saying there are certain categories of things that you just got to be able to constrain the amplification of.
Yeah, particularly where in some ways the amplification by the social media platform is creating an artificially large audience because it's been trained to believe that controversial things are good for engagement because they provoke reaction, and therefore what you want if you're an algorithm in a social media company is, you know, to for content that is as controversial and extreme as possible because that's going to make the most noise. But that is the very same content which needs to be mitigated rather than amplified.
And look, I think it's perfectly possible to believe that there's not some kind of malign team sat in Silicon Valley somewhere who've decided that controversial, outrageous content needs to be enhanced by the algorithm. It's perfectly possible that they have a machine that is learning through artificial intelligence what sort of content is engaging and gets more likes and gets more shares. And it's just learning as a machine to give more priority and amplification to that sort of content. And it's the sad truth is that a lot of that content may be appealing to baser human instincts and human nature, which means that we do find the more emotive, more outrageous, more shouty content stuff that we want to engage with because we're outraged by it or because we agree with it, but you know, it gives it an emotional reaction. We engage with it. The machine learns that's engaging. It amplifies it.
Absolutely. Jim, it's been great to talk to you today about the inquiry and indeed these evidence sessions for the podcast. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Infotagem podcast hosted by me, Damien Collins, and focused on the work of the Joint Committee on the Draft Online Safety Bill. This podcast was produced by David Dargahi. Thank you. Until next time.